Today's program has been brought to you by Heritage Foods USA, the nation's largest distributor of heritage breed pigs and turkeys. For more information, visit heritagefoodsusa.com.
I'm Grace Bonney of After the Jump, and you're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Hey, America, I'm Chad Pagano. I'm a former Army sniper, a chef instructor at the Institute of Culinary Education, and an avid lifelong hunter, and you're listening to the Wild Game Domain from the Hunt to the Hearth, airing live on Heritage Radio Network. My special guest today is a good friend of mine, but more importantly, he's an awesome chef, a great guy, football fan, one of those guys you could just talk to. His name is Chef James Brushione. Welcome aboard, Chef.
Thank you. Excited to finally make it onto the show.
I just want to read a little bit of your background here because, you know, I didn't know half of this here. I started doing some research on my guest today, and this guy began his culinary adventures as a dishwasher at a brunch joint down in Pensacola, Florida, and he never looked back. He gave up I thought he was lying about this, but apparently it's on the internet, so he's not. He gave up a college. Where were you going to play college football?
Swanee in Tennessee.
What division is that? Division two?
That's a D3.
Oh, okay. So he gave up this football career. And I know he could, you know, he's an athletic guy because he wanted to spend time in green markets and kitchens. He graduated, what did you do? You went to culinary? No, you just started working in the industry down at Highlands Bar and Grill in Birmingham, Alabama. He became the chef de cuisine there. He moved to New York City, where you got to move if you want to make it in this industry. And guess where he ended up? Only the best, one of the best restaurants in the world, Danielle. His real claim to fame, as far as I'm concerned, is aside from his athletic ability on the football field, is he is a two-time Food Network's CHOP champion. And he is currently the director of culinary development at the Institute of Culinary Education, and he trained in Europe. He went over to Europe for a while, trained in Venice, Italy in 2011 to learn sous vide techniques. Is that all about it? You have a book. He wrote a book with his lovely wife, Brooke Parkhurst, and it's called Just Married and Cooking. Is that about cover it, Chef?
Can we get 30 more minutes out of you just to saying good stuff?
Yeah, I guess
me?
We could.
That would be cool. Can we just do that for the chef?
How about tall, handsome? He interrupts my classes when he walks past my classroom. All the girls, I'm doing a demo, and all of a sudden one day I notice, I'm like, all right, guys, very important that you roll the dough. And I kind of glance up, and every one of my female students are looking, not to embarrass you, but are looking out the big glass doors. And I'm like, excuse me, am I talking? And then I look, and he's standing out there talking to someone. And they were like, sorry, Chef. Chef James is just so handsome. I'm like, oh, I'm sick of hearing about him and his handsomeness. But welcome aboard. I'm glad you can make it today.
Thank you.
All right. You know what I want to start with? And we could go through the whole thing because you have a great story. And people may be saying, well, all right, what's this guy's credentials to be on the Wild Game Domain? Well, you know what? He grew up south of the Mason-Dixon line. As far as I'm concerned, that makes you a lifetime member of the Wild Game Domain. but, you know, I've always appreciated from the minute I met you and got to experience your food, I always appreciated what I call your earthiness or your simple approach. I don't know how you want to define that, but just this idea that, you know, good, clean, pure ingredients cooked properly, you know, the whole farm to table kind of idea kind of seems to speak volumes for your food. Am I barking up the right tree there?
No, that's good. I like simple. I think when you say earthiness, it makes me feel like maybe I smell kind of bad and then I haven't showered enough.
No. Handsome, yeah, and he's handsome and he smells good. But go ahead.
It's simple. That was, you know, where I really, you know, started cooking and where I learned. One of my, you know, great mentor, Frank Stitt, down in Birmingham, Alabama, he, you know, spent a lot of time with Alice Waters and with Richard Olney over in France. And you know, that food is all about, you know, find the best ingredients and don't screw them up. Right. You know, get beautiful wild game. I grew up on the Gulf Coast, so, you know, for me, it's the amazing fish and oysters and all of those things. You know, I know a lot of people don't think about Florida and oysters, but, you know, just down the road from where I grew up in Apalachicola, you know, some of the best oysters in the world, when the hurricanes or BP aren't in there screwing things up.
Right.
But, you know, it's about, you know, finding these great, and as you know, you and your audience know, as hunters, you know, you go out and, you know, wild animals. I mean, that's the way it was meant to be. That's as good as it gets.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And there's a, you know, there's a whole story behind it. When you're out there harvesting your own food, as a hunter, gatherer, I don't care how you do it. You know, there's a story behind the food on the plate. And I think, you know, where you come from and the kind of food you foster tells that story, even as a chef, whether you're getting the oysters yourself, you know, you're finding these ingredients, these regional ingredients, really, and making great dishes with them. All right, I want to talk to you. I looked up two words today in the dictionary. You know me, I have to look up words. So I looked up molecular, and it said of or relating to molecules. And I was like, oh, so boring. And then I looked up gastronomy, and it said the art or science of good eating. And so if you put those together, what are we talking about? A small molecular way of eating? Or can you talk to me about this on some levels that I could understand?
Well, I'm a very simple man myself. I'm not that smart either. So I've got to keep it on that level to be able to understand it myself. You know, when it's amazing to me, and you well know this, how quickly we as a culture, as a society, can screw stuff up, and screw up terminologies and make things mean things that they don't actually mean.
Right.
Molecular gastronomy technically is the study of the science of cooking. It's the reactions that happen when meat touches fire. You know, that's the understanding those processes technically is what molecular gastronomy is.
Right.
Now, you know, a lot of really brilliant chefs got very interested in this concept of working with, you know, a few scientists who are really prolific in that subject as well. But, you know, their sort of avant-garde style of cooking, this really, you know, kind of, you know, fancy frou-frou, as you might call it, you know, way of eating in a restaurant, 30 courses, you know, these tiny little bites of this and that. That sort of avant-garde style got labeled as molecular gastronomy. The type of cooking was molecular gastronomy, where it's not. They're really two very different things, but I think it's something that everyone on some level is becoming more aware of. And whether you realize it or not, when you read an article about brining venison to make it more flavorful and more tender, that's has its basis in molecular gastronomy. So that's, you know, something I've become very interested in recently, and something that, you know, we're working a lot with our students and trying to see what we can find out, you know, there at ICE, to just know more about food. And the more, you know, the more we know, the better we can be at it, and the more interesting things we can do, and the better we can make everything taste.
Right. So as I'm, you know, experiencing the food you're creating through sous vide and some of the other techniques you use, you know, I kind of roll my eyes at some of it. But as far as wild game's concerned, you know, and I'm looking at the sous vide, you vacuum sealed this meat, you put it through this process that I want you to tell me about in a minute, but it's really the perfect foil for these lean, correct me if I'm wrong, these lean, gamey, kind of hard to work with cuts of meat that I'm using off white-tailed deer or any wild game, turkey, you know, various other wild game. Am I right about that? Can sous vide really be a good outlet for first of all, the home cook, but especially the hunter?
Well, we're kind of at this awesome place right now, I think, with sous vide, because the competition on the market right now is huge, and there's just companies coming in left and right, rolling out new, you know, machines to help in sous vide cooking. And when I say machines, it's really kind of a very simple, it's a cooking appliance. It's smaller than a toaster oven in most cases. You know, rolling out all of these new, and they're just getting less and less expensive. I think that was always the biggest roadblock into, you know, bringing sous vide to a wider audience, is that it just costs too much money.
Right.
You know, a few years ago, machines might cost up to $800. You can now see them on the market for right at $200. So the technology is way more accessible, and you know, in simple terms, it's, you know, it's nothing new. It's just kind of a more precise way to control low temperature cooking, and that's what really the whole sous vide technique is. It, you know, has this name, and that in French just means under vacuum, which means, you know, most people who are hunters are well familiar with their food saver, their little vacuum sealers that they use to preserve meat for the freezer anyway.
Absolutely.
Well, all we're doing is taking that meat that's sealed in that bag and then dropping it into a precisely controlled water bath that's going to cook it just to the dead perfect temperature. And the beauty part there is it's from edge to edge. You know, you're not throwing it on a hot grill where the outside is well done, and then you get that little nice little part of medium rare in the center the way you want it, but you get it medium rare from one end to the other all the way through. There's less moisture loss in the cooking because the meat's not going through such a shock of temperature. The muscle fibers aren't tightening as much during the cooking process, so they actually hold more of their natural moisture. And then, you know, of course, in that vacuum bag, you have the chance to, you know, add marinades and brines and all kinds of other things to, you know, enhance the flavor of the meat. I mean, I know you've seen, one of my favorite things to do is wrap something around with bacon before I put it into the sous vide. So you're kind of enhancing that meaty, smoky flavor infusing that meaty, smoky flavor into the food before the cooking process even begins.
Right. So could I, at home, when I'm using my food saver, make my cuts, put them in the bag, flavor them at that point, whatever I'm doing, brine them, put a little dry rub on my loin, vacuum seal it, freeze it, and then go right to the sous vide machine? Is that a possibility?
You can cook from frozen. Obviously, you know, it just means you're going to change your timing a little bit, because really, you know, sous vide cooking is all about timing. But the other beauty of it is, while it's about timing, the timing is really not that important, because, you know, if we're trying to cook a venison loin to 135 degrees internal temperature, well, I'm setting my water bath to 135 degrees, so it's never going to, it's
so hot.
Eventually it'll get tough and dry out, but it's not going to overcook in the matter of minutes like it is on your grill that's 400 degrees.
Right.
And you've got this, you know, tight little window of just the exact right moment to get it off the grill before it overcooks. You know, here, if I'm 20, 30 minutes late pulling it out of the water bath, not a problem at all. Nothing's changed.
Yeah.
The meat's still beautifully, perfectly medium rare.
And that's huge for a professional chef or at home. You know, if you're at home,
yeah,
you forget about it a little bit, had a couple too many bourbons. Oh, shit, the
sit
venison loin. Yeah.
That glass gets a little long all of a sudden. Right. You're still going to be okay.
You've been there. That's good. Okay, I want to tie this all in. So, you know, the sous vide, these techniques, this advancement really in cooking in general, kind of all came to life for you with this project you did with IBM.
It did. It's been a huge part of it. We've been for almost 2 years now working with IBM on this really interesting project. You know, IBM first came to us to talk about partnering on this really interesting idea they had. And basically what they wanted to do was see how computers could help people be more creative. And
you mean in general life, not just related to cooking?
Right. And, you know, in general, this is sort of what they believe. You know, IBM believes is kind of the next generation of computing technology. They've, you know, they built Watson, and Watson is, you know, helping doctors diagnose cancer in Sloan Kettering right now. And that's all dealing with information that already exists, that's already known. What they wanted to do was say, what can we do with what we don't know? What can we do? How can we teach a computer to one, be creative, and then two, to help people be more creative?
Wow.
The truth is there's a whole lot of stuff going on there that I don't understand, but in the end, what the system that we're working with is able to do is look at ingredients based on their chemical structure and then tell us predict what ingredients are going to taste good together based on the flavor compounds that they share.
Right. without
just something.
No, that's cool. And but listen, I want to talk more about that when we get back. I just noticed what time it is. We're going to take a short break here. I'm with my good friend, excellent chef James Brucione, and we'll be right back with the Wild Game Domain on HeritageRadioNetwork.org.
In 2001, Heritage Foods USA has sold pasture-raised, antibiotic-free heritage meats to restaurants and homes around the country. Our farmers raise their animals with care using traditional methods, guaranteed to produce the very best-tasting meat. Our pork breeds include Berkshire, Red Wattle, Duroc, Gloucester Old Spot, Large Black, and Tamworth, and our beef comes from Piedmontese, Angus Akiyushi, Belgian Blue, Highland, Simmental, and Belted Galloway cattle. We also carry a rotation of 24 rare breeds of heritage chicken, seasonal specialties like lamb, goat, geese, and of course, heritage turkeys. Visit us online at www.heritagefoodsusa.com or give us a call at 718-389-0985 to place your order today.
Hey, welcome back. I'm your host, Chad Pagano, and you're listening to the Wild Game Domain on HeritageRadioNetwork.org. I'm joined by my guest, Chef James Brucione. All right, James, let's get back to this. So they kind of programmed the computer. They didn't give it the answers, just they gave it the ability to access the chemical makeup of every food on the face of the earth and combine that for you within reason.
Yeah, essentially, right.
So
there's a lot of stuff that's not in there.
So I plug in pork chops.
Yep.
And it'll suggest I should do what?
Yeah, so that's kind of the cool part there is, we're trying to, and sort of the goal of the project is you say pork chops, immediately my brain goes apples, sage, rosemary, kind of standard traditional pairing.
You've been conditioned to think that way.
So what we want to do is go beyond that and say, well, what else is there out there that we're not thinking of that we would never imagine because we just there's no reason to ever put these together. But if we look at the science of it, we look at the flavor compounds that these ingredients contain. What do they have in common? And there's a theory out there that says the more flavor compounds any ingredient contains, the better they're going to taste together. So, if we look at pork, and then suddenly we're going to see, and we start arranging all of this data. And this is one of the ones actually the system came up with, that pork, chicken, mushrooms, strawberries, and pineapple all share common flavor ingredients. Hmm. Or your flavor compounds. So nothing that anyone would ever come up with, mushrooms, strawberries, pork, all together. But when you put the pieces together and actually cook it, there's something there that works out.
Right. That's cool. I mean, for me, and I'm sure like you, what grows together goes together, right? That's what we were trained kind of in. And I think that still fits. Is the IBM breaking that concept, or is it kind of enhancing it, or is it just building upon that?
I think there's you can use this, and one of the things we realized kind of as we got into the project, a big mistake that we made was we were always looking for that new, shocking, surprising, unusual thing to happen.
Right.
That pork, chicken, strawberry, mushroom kind of combination that we had never imagined before. But along the way, we found the pairings that, showed a lot of the common foods that we do love share a lot of the compounds, and we didn't track those, and I wish we would have. But there are, there's scientific proof that pizza is delicious because there are flavor compounds that mozzarella cheese, Parmesan cheese, and tomatoes all share. So if anyone ever argues with you that pizza is not delicious, there is, in fact, scientific proof to that fact.
Yeah, I don't accept that argument. I don't even argue with that. I like to argue, but that's ridiculous. Plus pizzas. I'm sitting in Roberta's. They proved it. right?
I know. Lord, I wish I could have gotten over there today for a little pizza.
Yeah. All right. So now, what was the public's reaction? You've been out and about. I think you went to Vegas or something with this project.
Yeah, we were in Vegas, and then we took it down to South by Southwest, IBM, and I built out a food truck that we were serving some of the dishes we created using this system. First of all, you're a giant outdoor festival handing out free food. Everybody's going to be excited no matter what's going on.
Right. But so, everyone knows everything about food down there. I mean, I got to imagine they're going to be critical, especially of food made by a computer.
Right. So there was definitely, once people kind of, people just like saw a food truck and just came and jumped in a huge line because they wanted to. And then they got up and they're like, wait, what are you guys doing here? That sounds ridiculous. But then we had them a bite of food and let them try it and let them taste it. And consistently people were surprised. Wow, this is really cool. This actually tastes really good. Never would imagine these things tasting good together. For me, the best part about it is me as the chef and my other partner, Michael Lascanis, in this. We still play a critical role. While the computer can help us come up with, interesting new combinations, it's not printing out recipes that we just go assemble. It's saying, hey, this list of ingredients is going to taste good together, but here, you, chef, go figure it out. Figure out how it works.
Right.
What's the main ingredient? What's the feature? How do we arrange all of these different things into a single dish? So, it's this awesome collaboration between the chef and the computer. It's not, the computers aren't taking over yet.
Okay.
We're getting a hell of a lot closer, but we're safe for now.
Good.
I'm trying to make friends so that when it happens, hey, come on, remember me? We used to cook all that cool stuff. It was good.
Have you seen Terminator? Come with me if you want to live. That's all I could think about. But no, so where is IBM going with this? I mean, IBM obviously wants to make a profit. Are they trying? Is this going to be on my computer? Am I going to have access to this someday? Are we going to see it in professional kitchens, home cooks, or they don't know? They're just kind of doing it.
Well, it's there's a lot of interesting ways that the technology can go. Obviously, the cooking application is really cool and fun, but they didn't build Watson to be the best trivia answerer. That's a word, isn't it? Answerer.
I don't know. Ask Watson or Jack, my producer. He's smart too.
They didn't build Watson just to answer trivia questions. They built Watson with a purpose, but of course, competing on Jeopardy was the great showcase for it.
Right.
So, this cooking application is a great showcase, and they're actually, there's definitely some great potential here with the cooking that they could develop further. But this, I think, has applications, in every creative field that there is, and in every looking at consumer electronics, and it can look at the trends of what people are interested in, and as we see, even TVs now do more than they ever did before. It can help figure out like what would be the best combination of features for a TV to have, web enabled and whatever the hell it built into it. I don't know. I still have an old TV with tinfoil on it. So.
All right, that's cool. All right, I want to backtrack now. So you obviously you got into food. You grew up down south. You got into a food. Was that from your family, the culture you grew up in, the people around you? How did you get interested in food? And talk a little bit about what food meant to you growing up and kind of before you became a chef.
I always wish I had one of those awesome stories. Like, oh man, I remember from the time that I was a kid. My mom was always in. My mom was not a great cook. Okay, but if she ever hears this, she'll agree with me. She's okay with it. She's come to terms with it. She made dinner for us every night, and it wasn't bad. It just it was dinner. We ate every night. My family is Italian, and so when we would go visit my grandmother, of course, amazing. Chicken cacciatore, I remember so well from her. And great meals there, but it was never a huge thing for me. Honestly, I got into food because I was 16 years old. I got a job washing dishes, and my very first night working in a restaurant, I come in, lanky 16-year-old awkward kid, not knowing really what to do or what's going on. I just show up and basically like waterproof boots and you know, some old clothes to stand in the back and wash dishes all night. And so I get back there, and they tell me that the other dishwasher just quit that morning. So I'm on my own at a restaurant that serves on summer nights, serves like 800 people.
Nice.
So they pull some busboy off of his shift and throw him back there in the dishes with me. So he's less than pleased to be washing dishes all night with some, you know, stupid teenage kid who has no idea what he's doing. And we start, you know, just battling through it. And, like, we'll have this giant stack of dishes in front of us, and we, you know, work it down, and I go, oh my gosh, okay, well, cool, we're almost there. And then the restaurant operated on two levels, and all of a sudden, you know, they would bring up a trolley from downstairs just full of plates and pots and dishes and dump it on us and, like, pile it back up again. So we're just getting crushed all night long. About just after midnight, one of the managers comes back with a tray on it, and it's got four beers and an ashtray, and just sets it back on top of the dishwasher. It's like, oh, guys, I know this has been brutal. You know, keep it up. You're almost there. And I look at the other dishwasher. I'm like, really? He's like, yeah, man. He hands me a beer. I'm like, this is the coolest job in the world. I'm 16 years old.
Right.
It's midnight. It's past midnight. I'm still out.
And I'm having a beer.
I'm at work getting paid, and they just gave me beer, and I can smoke.
Nice. Like,
this is awesome. And at that moment, I absolutely fell in love with just the whole world of restaurants and the life of being in a restaurant. I spent, you know, I probably, you know, that was why I only got Division III offer to play college football. If I'd spent as much time, you know, interested in football as I did being interested in the kitchen.
Smoking and drinking and doing dishes, you would have been all right.
Exactly. Exactly.
That's awesome. I love that story because, you know, you talk to 10 chefs, nine of them are going to say, I grew up in a family where it was all about food and, you know, from a young age. So I love that story. You're honest about it. That's great. All right. Your book, your cookbook, Just Married and Cooking. We only have a minute left, but you've been married about 100 years now to Brooke, haven't you? I've known Brooke a while.
Oh, man. It just feels like yesterday, just in case she ever listens to this also. We've been married 5 years now, and we wrote the book during our first year of being married. You know, she's a brilliant writer. She wrote a novel called Belle and the Big Apple that came out the year before we got married, and that story about a Southern girl moving to New York City. And you know, we were kind of at this spot where we were, you know, I'd been a chef in a restaurant for 13 years, and now suddenly I was going to be this settled domestic guy with a wife, and we were going to be having a kid, and, you know, these new things were happening. And,
no more
and it was
drinking
kind of,
and smoking and hanging out with the dishwashers anymore.
Until 2 a.m., exactly. Right. So, you know, it was this way of how are we going to figure out this new life together and what we're going to do and how, you know, we're going to put it all together. So it's kind of the story of our new life and the things we love to cook and eat, whether we were, you know, having a dinner, just the two of us, on a Wednesday night, or if we're, you know, entertaining with friends. It was just, you know, and so it's just a great collection. It's like 200 recipes of all the food we love to cook and share with each other and with friends. And, yeah, it's great.
Yeah, no, it's a great book. And I busted his chops about it when it first came out a little bit, making fun of it. You know, we make fun of each other. And but I got to be honest with you, it's a great book, great recipes. Thank you for having me grill romaine for my wife now every time I'm down at that godforsaken beach with her. She's like, we're having grilled romaine, right? I could splash anything on top of that. As long as I grill the romaine, she's happy. And she got that from your book. So thank you very much.
Of course.
Listen, man, thanks for joining us today. I really appreciate it. It was great having you.
Of course. Yeah, I'm sorry we didn't get a chance to get into football, but I just got an ESPN alert. Eli threw two interceptions while we were just talking here on the show.
Good. He'll get him all out of the way now at the OTAs, because those interceptions are going to really mean something. You know what? I just looked at the clock. It's 11:29. We got one more minute. Your professional football team, the Washington Redskins, right? You're a Redskins fan?
Absolutely.
How do we feel about the name? Be honest.
How do we feel about the name?
Yeah.
Okay, so
where do you stand on this?
Did you know that name was offensive before everybody started getting really upset about it?
No, I really didn't. I didn't until
I didn't either.
Until we honestly broke it down in the office the other day. I never even gave it a second thought. You know, it was the name of the Redskins. It's an iconic football organization. It's had that name forever. But we are where we are now, right? So how would you feel if they changed it? Or do you think they should? Where do you stand totally on this?
I can go either way on it. What if you're just the Skins? Is that going to make anybody mad? Is that not going far enough away? Like, what's the right answer here?
Right.
Because I think the team's got a right to their heritage and their history. And I mean, there's a lot of tradition in that, both good and bad, in that club. So, you know, I mean, what are we supposed to do? What's going to make everybody happy?
All right, fair enough. Yeah. Yeah.
Should, I don't know, should Dan Snyder just give up all of his money and go live in a teepee and call ourselves the Washington Cream Puffs and then everybody's good? Or is that offensive to
pastry chefs?
That's got to be offensive to somebody.
Yeah, it's offensive to pastry chefs. I can't have that. No.
Yeah.
Just what we'll do is we'll just change the name of all the teams in the football, in the NFL, to maybe we'll call them the Footballers. So
yeah, well, how about the Washington Human Beings? Is that that's safe, right? Could we just be the Washington Humans?
That's offensive to non-humans. What about all the deer, the whitetails, and the wild turkey? All right, James. Thanks a lot. Chef James Brucione, great guest. Thanks for being with us today, buddy.
Thank you. All right.
That's all the time we have. I'd like to thank Jack for producing and engineering today's show. You can always find archived episodes of The Wild Game Domain from The Hunted Hawk on heritageradionetwork.org. Thank you.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.